The Outlaws and the Tramp. It was Saturday afternoon, and the Outlaws were on their way to the woods with Jumble at their heels. They turned a bend in the road, and there, on the roadside before them, sat a tramp. He was a gloriously unkempt tramp with long sandy hair and a straggling red beard. He wore the brim of an old straw hat at a jaunty angle. His boots were tied on with string. He was cooking something over a smoky fire. The Outlaws stood around him.
"Hallo, my boys," he greeted them cheerfully. "Where are you off to with that fine dog?"
William's heart warmed to him. So few people perceived the fineness of Jumble at first sight like this. That fine dog proved the tramp to be a man of perspicacity and understanding.
"Can we stay and watch you?" said William.
"Sit down and welcome, young gents," said the tramp genially.
They sat round in a semicircle and watched the progress of the tramp's meal. He drank the steaming concoction straight from the tin. Then, from a large flapping pocket, he drew a penknife and a lump of cheese. Having eaten this with gusto, he drew from another part of his person a bottle, whose contents he drank with even greater gusto. Then he lay back on the path with a sigh of content, his hands behind his head, gazing up at the sky. William broke the spellbound silence with which they had watched him.
"Can anyone be one?" he said eagerly.
"Be one what?" said the tramp.
"A tramp," said William. "We'd all like to be them."
The tramp's eyes twinkled.
"Well, it's not an easy life," he said.
But he looked so carefree and merry as he said it that the Outlaws didn't believe him for a second.
"You can do just what you like, can't you?" said Ginger.
"Oh, yes," said the tramp.
"And go where you like," said Douglas.
"And eat when you like," said Henry.
"And wear what you like," said William, gazing with admiration at the fluttering rags and the boots tied on with string.
"Oh, yes," said the tramp.
"Well," said William, "I suppose we can't be one till we're grown up, but what we want to know is how to get into it then, because I bet we all want to start the minute we're 21, don't we?" he said to the others.
The others agreed.
"Well, now," said the tramp confidentially, "it's not generally known that it's as difficult to get into as many of the other professions.
If you've got to pass examinations in not washing and in eating like you do," said William, "I bet we'd soon pass 'em."
"No, it's not that. It's just that this is one of the professions you've got to pay your way into."
The faces of the Outlaws fell.
"All I can say," said the tramp kindly, "is that you're lucky to have met me, because I'm the head of the whole tramp profession, and no one can get into it except through me."
The Outlaws heaved deep sighs of ecstasy. They saw themselves in a gloriously unwashed and unbrushed future, roaming the countryside, cooking strange picnic meals on fires they had made themselves, going to bed as late as they liked, climbing trees, and sleeping in barns or by the roadside.
"Now I'll do what I can for you," went on the tramp. "If I pass you into the profession, as it were, then we'll give you all our tips. We'll tell you the places where the people will give you food and the places where they won't. And we'll tell you the woods where you can poach safely and the woods where you can't. But there's got to be a sort of entrance fee, of course. It's only fair, isn't it?"
The Outlaws agreed that it was, but their spirits had fallen.
"How much is it?" said William.
The tramp swept a speculative glance over them, then said,
"2 shillings each.
There was a dejected silence. The Outlaws consulted together.
"But we haven't got any money just now," began William.
"Tell you what," interrupted the tramp good-humouredly, "I've taken a liking to you for. You're the sort we want on the road, see? I feel you'd be a credit to us."
The Outlaws swelled visibly with pride.
"I'll come back here in a week's time. You'll be able to get the money by then, won't you?"
The Outlaws promised eagerly.
"Well, we'll meet right here. You'll give me your entrance fees, and I'll give you an envelope containing an address that you must go to when you're ready to start in the profession. Oh, now that's a thing I've never done for anyone else."
The Outlaws thanked him profusely.
He held up his hand. "There's only one condition. Will each of you young gents give me a solemn promise not to breathe a word of this to anyone till we meet next week?"
The outlaws promised solemnly. The tramp rose, stretching himself luxuriously.
"Well, goodbye then. Till next week."
And he strolled off down the road, whistling gaily. The outlaws gazed after him till he had disappeared. Then once more they drew deep breaths of ecstasy.
"Fancy that happening to us," said William at last.
"I'm going to tie my boots on with string, same as him," said Douglas.
"It's more possible than being pirates or Red Indians," said Henry. "I'm glad we've chosen it."
2 shillings each," said William. "That's, 8 shillings altogether."
"We've got to get it,"
said Ginger sternly.
"Course we have," agreed William.
"It would be awful," said Douglas, "to have to be a doctor or lawyer or something like that when we grew up, just for want of 2 shillings now."
"How much money would you have to spend on me being a doctor if I wanted to be one?" William asked his mother that evening.
"Do you want to be a doctor, dear?" said Mrs. Brown absently.
"If you do, you'll have to work much harder at school and be a lot cleaner and tidier than you are now."
I don't want to be a doctor," said William. "But how much would you have to spend for me to be a doctor?"
"Oh, several hundred pounds, I believe."
"Well," said William, "I'm going to save you all that money. If you give me 2 shillings now, you needn't spend all that money making me a doctor."
"Oh, do run away, dear, and stop talking nonsense," said Mrs. Brown.
William walked slowly up to his sister Ethel's bedroom and knocked at the door. She greeted him without enthusiasm.
"Well, what do you want?"
"Ethel, would you like to do something about my future?" Ethel glanced at him, still without enthusiasm.
"Yes, I would. I'd like to do quite a lot about your future.
How would you like never to see me again after I'm 21?
It seems a long time to wait."
William ignored the insult.
"Well, if you'll give me 2 shillings, you'll never see me again after I'm 21.
"I think you're rather optimistic," said Ethel. "Personally, I think you'll get put in prison long before you're 21.
William's eyes roved round the room. Upon the chest of drawers stood the photograph of a good-looking young man in a silver frame with the name Jimmy scrawled across it. It was the only photograph in the room. A few weeks ago, Ethel's room had been full of framed photographs of eligible youths, all affectionately inscribed. But a young man named Jimmy Moore had supplanted all of them in her normally variable affections. At this moment, Ethel caught sight of Jimmy entering the garden gate. She blushed, smiled, waved her hand, and started for the door. As she passed the photograph, she stopped, then, with a sudden movement, opened the top drawer, took out an armful of the deposed photographs, and flung them scornfully into the fireplace. William was about to follow her out of the room when he halted. Photographs! People paid money for photographs, didn't they? Clearly Ethel didn't want them. He gathered them up and took them into his bedroom. Next day, Ethel and her mother were discussing a bazaar. Something his mother said suddenly interested William.
"Do you mean," he said, "that anyone can sell their things at the bazaar?"
"I suppose so, dear," said Mrs. Brown, "if they'd got anything that anyone would want to buy."
William went straight up to his bedroom. Ethel's photographs. These men's mothers or aunts might be at the bazaar and might want to buy their photographs. It was worth trying. On the day of the bazaar, there was an undercurrent of excitement in the crowded village hall. Dolly Clavis, a comely damsel of about 18, was making her way tempestuously to the door. Her head was held high, and her eyes were flashing angrily. Beside her, pale and distraught, strode George, Douglas's brother. He was running his hands through his hair in some desperation.
"I tell you, it's all a mistake," he said. "I never admired her, never.
"Oh, no, never," cried Dolly sarcastically. "And there's your photograph standing for the whole world to see with two Ethel from her most humble and faithful admirer, George. Going round giving your photographs to Ethel Brown with stuff you ought to be ashamed of written all over them and then pretending you love me." "I do love you," protested the youth wildly. "It was months ago and I didn't mean it even at the time, and it was before I got to know you. And I tell you, I hate Ethel Brown and I never want to see you again. Go away. I hate you. Oh, listen," pleaded the youth. "Listen, just listen."
They had reached the door. Another youth and damsel were entering. This youth was Hector, Ginger's brother and George's friend. This damsel was a local belle called Peggy Barton. As the couples passed each other, George just had time to pull his friend aside and whisper wildly, "Go and buy your photograph. Quick, over there, in that corner. Don't let her see." Hector pushed his way through the crowd. There, behind a stall made up of two packing cases, stood William, Ginger, Douglas, and Henry. On the packing cases was ranged a heterogeneous assortment of rubbish, and in the front of it, a row of photographs. All Hector saw was his own photograph. It was inscribed in mountainous letters with the words, "To Ethel, the most beautiful girl in the world, from her faithful Hector." There was only one thing to be done, and Hector did it. He took out the first coin his fingers came on, it happened to be a shilling, flung it at William, seized his photograph, crumpled it up, and thrust it into his pocket. The outlaws were surprised and bewildered by the success of their stall. In just half an hour, all eight photographs had been hurriedly purchased by eight anxious young men.
"I say, suppose he doesn't come," said Ginger.
"I bet he'll come," said William. "He's a bit late," said Douglas.
"Well, he's a sort of king of the tramps," said Henry. "I expect he's jolly busy. Probably they've got some sort of a parliament on, and he's got to open it or something."
At that moment, the gaily swaggering figure appeared at the end of the road and waved to them in friendly greeting. They ran towards him excitedly.
"Ho, ho! Well, this is splendid," he said. "Got your money?"
Yes," said William. "Oh, yes, we've got the money all right. Have you got the address?"
With impressive dignity, the sandy gentleman took a grimy envelope out of his pocket.
"Now, you must promise not to open this till 3 minutes after I've gone, and you must never show anyone what's inside it."
Thrilling from head to foot with excitement, the outlaws promised.
"Well, now, let's have your money."
The outlaws held out grimy hands, in each of which reposed two very warm shillings. But at that very moment, round the bend in the road came a policeman, and in the same instant the tramp seemed suddenly and miraculously to vanish.
"Trying to get money out of you, was he?" said the policeman.
"Do you know him?" said William.
"Oh, should think I do. We all know Sandy Dick. He can get money out of anyone. I suppose he was getting it out of you."
"He's left the address anyway," said William,
picking up the envelope which the tramp had dropped at the policeman's appearance. Eagerly he tore it open. There was nothing inside it.
"What did you think there'd be inside?" said the policeman.
They told him the whole story. He put back his head and roared with laughter. The policeman's raucous merriment stripped the whole exploit of its glamour and revealed them to themselves as inglorious dupes. But inglorious as the affair might be, it had its redeeming features. The outlaws surveyed the wealth that was left so unexpectedly on their hands.
"Come on," said William. "I'm jolly hungry. Let's go and buy some lemonade and cream blodgers."
They walked down to the village with a carefree, nonchalant swagger that was partly a copy of Sandy Dick's and partly expressive of their feelings. 8 shillings are 8 shillings, and a feast of lemonade and cream blodges in the hand is, after all, worth any amount of glorious careers in the bush.